change in our schedule, I see that you all are in place. And this panel of today for our Second Court of Appeals is to my left, Justice Stoffino, and to my right, Justice Walker, and I'm Bill Meyer, and I'll be your presiding justice today. And we have two cases set for submission at 9 o'clock and then one at 10:30. So we'll see how we do that in terms of whether we take a recess or how we'll do that as we move along this morning. We appreciate you all being here to offer us oral argument, and I'd ask the clerk to call the cases for submission.
May it please the court. This is a defamation case. And the issue that you have to decide is this: whether a person who's a member of a board in a public meeting can publish a defamation with knowing that it is false and there's no liability. That is the issue you have to decide. Since 1966, I've been representing print and electronic media, and I appreciate very much the fact that all of our public meetings need to be open, they need to be robust, they need to be able to discuss the issues and the folks involved in that not be subject to litigation. But does that principle, which is important to us, include publishing a defamation with knowing falsity of it? That's the issue this court is faced with. The posture of the case is simple. Appellee's motion for summary judgment in its entirety was granted. Our motion for partial summary judgment on liability was denied. Now, what is not before you? What's not before you is there is no dispute about the grammar as applied to the publication. They do not make any attempt to show that our grammatical analysis of this publication is wrong at all. They do not attempt to show that our grammatical analysis, that one person was speaking for all the appellees, they don't attempt to show any of that's wrong. So what we're here to decide is their immunity defense good, or were we deficient in our proof, or do they have affirmative defenses? But as to whether or not this is defamatory and knowingly published, which we spent about a fourth of our brief on, they don't even attempt to attack that. So that's not before you. And all language has to be interpreted in accordance with ordinary rules of grammar.
It seems to me on page 13 of the appellee's brief, they go through a discussion of why the statements are defamatory.
So that is correct. Their contention that they have defenses to this, that's what's before you. And those defenses that they're talking about, some of them, for example, that we didn't put any proof on the state of mind of the individuals publishing it. Well, this court in 2007 says state of mind's not an issue, but that's one of the defenses they wrote. They say that this was invited and consented. Well, that's a little difficult in a public meeting where you're following rules of protocol as to who speaks and who gets a second and who has a right. They're also saying that they have a privilege defense. No question that our client, Mrs. Thomason, is a public figure. And you have to prove actual malice. What's actual malice? That you published a defamatory statement with knowledge it was false. So that's also a defense that they have raised. They also say that our level of proof was not sufficient. We didn't prove it by clear and convincing evidence. Here again, in 2007, Justice Holman, writing for this court, cited the Supreme Court in 2000 and says, clear and convincing is not an issue here. But yet, those are the things that they have raised in response to our language. So it comes down to this. Can a person who's a member of a board in a public meeting publish a defamation knowingly? And there's no liability. They're either immune from liability or one of these affirmative defenses affects it. What public policy would support that? I've not found any case out there that says that would be supported by that. So it really amounts to this. When you come to a public meeting and the grammar applied to the language satisfies the legal definition of defamation, and you present proof that the person publishing it knew it was false, you've established malice. I cannot see how, under those circumstances, that you either have an immunity, because the three requirements for immunity cannot be met by that, and malice is what defeats qualified privilege and all of the other defenses. Really, the case is that simple. It's not complicated, and that's the decision the court's going to have to make, because when your opinion comes out, the opinion's going to contain the language that we've alleged is defamatory. Everybody out there can read that language and apply ordinary rules of grammar and look at it and say, that's what that says. They can look at the evidence and determine, did that person know that that was false? Now, that's just plain seventh grade grammar is all that is. So really, all you're faced with here is their immunity defense good, or are their affirmative defenses good? And did we fail in our burden? Under the fact that the language can't change, that's a legal issue for you to determine that applying grammar. When it comes to the malice, those facts about it being known, it's undisputed. So that's really all you have. Now, they do make one argument. They said we waived our issue on punitive damages. Well, if you prove malice, according to this court's 2007 opinion, you've not waived punitive damages, because that's what entitles you to punitive damages. Thank you very much.
Please, the court.
Mr. Lyon.
Good morning. This is styled as a defamation case. Actually, it is a legitimate dispute over the management of a homeowners association. Now, let me give you a little background, although most of this is in the brief, about why we're here. This is the Pecan Plantation Owners Association. All of these folks were on the board. Mrs. Linda Tomlinson was the president of the board back in 2009, and some issues developed over the way she was managing her presidency. There was one specific incident that needs a little more description, and that's the fact that the Homeowners Association was sued by a local land developer for charging road impact fees. In other words, he didn't want to have to pay the association for driving his commercial vehicles on their streets. And that case was eventually settled, and it was settled by Mrs. Tomlinson's predecessor, a man named Lowry, who was the president of the association. He negotiated it. It brought it back to the board. It passed. Two of the people who voted against it, Ms. Wilson and Mr. McComas, are defendants. Ms. Tomlinson voted for it. Well, shortly after the settlement was reached, Mr. Lowry went to work for the developer. And that created in the minds of many members of the Homeowners Association, specifically Mr. McComas for one, that there was a potential conflict in Mr. Lowry leaving his position as presidency after negotiating this settlement and then going to work for the Homeowners Association. Now, the board did have an attorney, their attorney, look into this issue, Mr. Halliburton in Arlington. He wrote the board a letter, said several things, one of which that the board could have a discussion with Mr. Lowry. He commented there was no blueprint for this type of situation, and that it would be good if the board exercised its own judgment. And that's in the record at 2CR 332 through 336. Well, Mrs. Tomlinson, the president, took that letter and sent an email to all of the members of the board, including these defendants. And in the email, she said, "What I want to know is, do you as a director of the board of the PPOA believe this matter has been adequately addressed, and you agree with our attorney that the agreement was approved as being fair to the association? If you so agree, I would expect you to admit that no further review is needed in this case." Now, that is the issue that ultimately became one of the points in these five members wanting to set aside the presidency. A meeting was called on October 5th, a special meeting, to determine whether or not Ms. Tomlinson should be asked to step down as president, not as a member of the board. And at that statement, Mr. McComas read into the record a statement he had prepared. Now, it's important in his affidavit. He said, "I prepared this statement." And keep in mind, in the backdrop of all this, the plaintiffs have not deposed any of the defendants. They've not asked Mr. McComas anything about it. They have not asked Ms. Wilson, Mr. Rabinius, Mr. Roman, Mr. Jensen, any of the defendants about this incident. Now, the statement, which is in the record, goes on and on and on, and basically, Mr. McComas is expressing his opinion as to why Mrs. Tomlinson should step down from the presidency. If you look through the statement, there are seven different issues raised, from keeping the employee salary secret from the board to several issues. And one of them, which is why these folks got sued, is his belief and his statement that he thought it was unethical for Mrs. Tomlinson not to investigate the fact that Mr. Lowry settled it and then went to work for the guy he settled it with. Now, I know this court, and I disagree with Mr. Sharp. It's this court determines what's defamatory, not his idea about grammatical interpretation. But when you look through Mr. McComas's statement, he, on two different spots, quoted from the bylaws of the Homeowners Association to be scrupulously honest and straightforward in all dealings, to avoid situations where there might appear to be an unethical or illegal behavior. Then he read again during his statement from the mission statement, "Officers, board members, and management of the corporation will set an example of the highest ethical conduct." Now, it is this court's obligation to determine whether those statements, in the context of this entire delivery by Mr. McComas, are defamatory. Now, he says unethical. Clearly, the board bylaws require ethical conduct toward the members. It was his opinion, as stated, that the failure to investigate didn't meet that ethical standard of a board member. So we will go through a little bit further whether or not this is defamatory, but taken in context, the use of the word unethical is appropriate considering the board bylaws. Now, before I go into all of what we believe are the appropriate reasons why the court's judgment should be affirmed, let me talk a little bit about Mrs. Wilson, Mr. Roman, Mr. Robinius, and Mr. Jensen. They are here not under the evidence in this record, but under grammatical construction. The record is clear. Mr. McComas said, "I wrote the statement." There were no depositions taken. There is nothing in this record that any of the other defendants either approved, adopted, agreed with any of the statements they made. Now, they all agreed, and that is when you read this statement, that Mrs. Tomlinson should step down. And basically, the appellant is saying that these four people should be held guilty of actual malice because Mr. Tomlinson said "we." So I'm going to go through why I believe the statement wasn't defamatory at all, but clearly there is no evidence for the four defendants I mentioned. Now, it is this court's obligation to determine what is and is not defamatory. And frankly, this court has written a lot on defamation over the years. Billington versus Houston Fire, this court determined that liar and crook were not defamatory without innuendo. Now, there is no allegation of innuendo. There is no innuendo. So you begin to wonder if unethical, can that be defamatory when liar and crook isn't? The Dallas Court of Appeals in Moore versus Jaffe, which is also in our opinion, said that calling someone a phony, a cheat, and a crook is not defamatory. So, frankly, I practiced with an older lawyer for a long time who would say, the hunt's over. This is just not defamation. And, of course, obviously she has to prove not only was the statement about her, but it was defamatory. Then we get to false, and since she was a public figure, actual malice. So, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, we don't have to go any further. Saying someone is unethical in the conduct in which, the context in which this statement was made is not defamation. Now, let's talk a bit about malice. We provided this court with the affidavit of Mr. McComas, who set forth the fact that he had conducted an investigation, that he believed that what he said in his statement was true, and he gave a plausible basis for why he believed it was true. And clearly, when you read Mrs. Tomlinson's email, she wasn't asking for a fair hearing into Mr. Lowry's conduct. She was trying to shut it down. So his opinion was that she should have gone further. Now, this court in Star Telegram versus Judge Street, said that an affidavit is appropriate to defeat malice if it shows a belief in the truth and a plausible basis. There is no evidence in this record to contradict what Mr. McComas said in that affidavit. That affidavit defeats malice. So at this point, I believe we have a statement that's not defamatory. I would hope that this court would find that based on other opinions. And there's no evidence to show that Mr. McComas didn't believe what he was saying and didn't have a plausible reason. So there is no malice. Now, Mr. Sharp mentioned, and this is true, we filed dueling summary judgments. We asked for the entire case to be dismissed. He asked for a partial summary judgment on liability. He's appeared in this court not asking that the case be remanded. He's asking that the court reverse the opinion of Judge Walton and render judgment for them based on this evidence. Just to take a second to get rid of this clear and convincing argument, there is no question that all the plaintiff has to show to defeat the requirement of clear and convincing evidence on malice is a material fact under preponderance of the evidence. We don't dispute that. Where they're, I think, sort of stepping out of line is they're saying that, well, we win if we show by a preponderance of the evidence. And that is clearly not true. It would be their burden at trial to prove malice of all these folks by clear and convincing evidence. And we believe that if they're going to prevail and get this thing rendered, they have to have evidence of clear and convincing evidence. And that's just not here. When you look through this entire record, it is just not here. One of the other statements that they point to is a statement that Mr. McComas, according to the transcript, said that it was ill-minded to reject a examination of Mr. Lowry's conduct. We also provided for the court the DVD, because these things are televised and played on closed-circuit television all over the Homeowners Association, the actual statement. And I think and this would be a great job for law clerks to go look at the DVD, you'll see that what Mr. McComas said was single-minded. But frankly, when you go back two definitions of defamation, or terms that have been found to be defamatory. If liar, crook, and cheat aren't defamatory, surely even ill-minded isn't defamatory. Now, we also have other defenses, a qualified privilege. Clearly, Mr. McComas, as a member of the board, had the obligation to bring issues to the board. They had the obligation to consider them. We think that under this record, the qualified privilege applies. Also, in regard to falsity, they have to show that it was not substantially true. And I believe under this evidence, you will see that when you consider her email, you consider her, the obligation of the board to behave ethically toward the board members. What he said was substantially true. She didn't want an investigation. She sent an email to the other board members, in effect, saying, let's just approve it the way it is, the way I, since she approved it in the first place. Also, we've got 221 of the business organizations code. I'm still trying to get used to that one. In order for the plaintiff to prevail under the defense provided by that section, they have to prove the negative. They have to prove that these folks were not acting in good faith. There's certainly all the evidence in the world they were acting in good faith. That they didn't use ordinary care. The affidavit of Mr. McComas, who wrote the statement, talks about the investigation he went into, talking to another lawyer to try to get the board to examine what had occurred with Mr. Lowry's settlement. And they have to prove that it was not in the best interest of the organization. It is pretty clear that not charging fees for the use of their roads except in limited situations is not in the best interest of the organization. It would have been in the best interest of the organization to look into this settlement. So we feel that, again, 221 is a defense available to all of these defendants. I will concede if we had actual malice, I think that they couldn't have acted in good faith. Excuse me, but there is no evidence of that. There is also the evidence we believe they have waived any argument on punitive damages by not bringing it forward. And we have raised consent. Excuse me. Trial lawyer not being able to talk is not a very good trial lawyer. Now, consent is, frankly, I put it at the bottom of the list because it is not what I believe to be our strongest defense in this case. But she is the president of the board. The board meeting was specially called to ask her to step down. Mr. McComas made the motion for her to step down. It was seconded, and then discussion was had. And during discussion, there are several people, when you read through all this, who discussed what they believe. Some believe she did a good job. Some believe she did a bad. I will. I didn't see. I apologize. Basically, Your Honor, we have alleged several defenses. The court didn't specify the grounds. So if any one of them is good, they're all good. Or at least we win.
Your Honor, there's no question, and I think I made the point initially. The court determines as a legal issue whether the language is defamatory. Ordinary rules of grammar are simply the tool that the court uses to measure and interpret the language against what the law is. That's our argument. If you'll notice, at no point have they been able to show that the grammatical construction we set out doesn't accuse Mrs. Tomlinson of unethical conduct and conflict of interest, which he never mentioned, that cost the association serious money, thousands of dollars, and maybe millions. There's no question about that. So it really comes back to this. Are these statutes, the one about the public meeting, does that completely give anybody participating it free rein to defame anybody that they want. And when you look at the evidence, that's what this court's going to have to decide. Thank you very much.
Counsel, we appreciate your presentation of your case and your briefing and your argument here this morning, and your case will be submitted.